delighted to welcome you all to our February oral argument calendar. And our first case is 11-AT-2548-CR, State versus Lee M. Rocha Mayo. And arguing on behalf of the defendant is attorney Rex Andrake. Counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning, Justices of the Supreme Court and Counsel. My name is Rex Andrake, and I represent the defendant appellant petitioner in this case, Luis Rocha Mayo. On behalf of my client and my own behalf, I'd like to thank the Wisconsin Supreme Court for accepting the petition for review and everything that goes along with that. Unless there are any questions about the third issue, I'm going to focus today on breath tests.
What's the third issue, harmless error?
Third issue would be
the
testimony of the doctor.
Okay.
On the issue.
And the fourth issue was harmless error?
Pardon?
Are you going to talk about harmless error?
I will, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, could I ask you right off the bat? There are multiple convictions here, and you're focusing on the PBT. Does that affect all of the convictions, or most of the convictions, or one of the convictions?
Well, as I believe it affects the major conviction, it certainly affects the conviction for homicide by intoxicated use of a motor vehicle. But I think it also affects the reckless homicide charge as well, because I think the sort of the mindset that is an element of that crime is something that would certainly be affected by the juror's perception or belief or conclusion that the defendant was intoxicated, not in a good state of mind at that point. At the time of the accident.
Were all of the convictions appealed?
They were. I believe the operating after revocation conviction is obviously not something that I'm terribly concerned about today.
Well, your notice of appeal to the Court of Appeals said that you're appealing from the final judgment of conviction, which that covered all the felonies?
Yes.
An order denying post-conviction relief entered in this one number, 2008 CF-660. So your position is you're appealing everything.
That's correct, Your Honor. The two issues that are presented specifically about breath tests is the first, their general admissibility in an OWI prosecution, and also second, whether they should be given any kind of a prima facie effect in such a case.
Can I just ask a background question just to get a feel for how this case was tried? What was the defense? Was it just we're putting the state to its burden, or did he offer a defense such as, you know, the defense that, unfortunately, the death would have occurred even if the defendant would have been exercising due care? What was the defense? Because these sometimes are a little tricky, and they're different depending on how they're tried.
The defense was, in part, that the defendant was not intoxicated, in another part, that the due care defense, that this accident would have occurred even if he had not been intoxicated.
Was that instruction given to the jury, the due care instruction?
Yes it was.
Okay. So the defense was, I wasn't intoxicated, but if I was intoxicated, then the accident would have happened anyway.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Was there no element of self-defense involved in this portrayal of what was going on here?
Well, I certainly think the facts had that flavor, given everything that had happened. But there was no self-defense, per se, defense raised during the trial. In what the court might rightfully perceive as me leading with my strongest issue, I'm going to begin by talking about the prima facie effect, because I think it's on that issue where the differences between the PBT in the other kind of breath test that the legislature did expressly authorize to be admissible in this kind of case resonates most profoundly. And I recognize that there's an argument here that this court should look at that first issue, which is the base admissibility of the PBT, without considering at all the type of breath test we get in 343.305. But when you look at the prima facie effect issue, I don't think you can quite so easily ignore Section 343.305. And there's no dispute here that a breath test taken under 343.305 is entitled to that prima facie effect. The legislature has made that quite clear by expressly attaching that presumption to those kinds of tests under that sub 5, sub D. And this court has noted on many past occasions a direct connection between the presumptions associated with chemical tests and the implied consent law. Dish, McCrossin, Bush are all cases where that was, where this court noted that.
Counsel, is there any indication in the record that the doctor taking this test, ordering the test taken, was in some way cooperating with law enforcement?
To my knowledge, there's no indication whatsoever of any law enforcement involvement in the doctor's decision to order the test. This court has stated that the tests specified under the implied consent law are entitled to a presumption of accuracy, and that a method or process for testing, which is expressly authorized by statute, is entitled to a prima facie presumption of correctness. That prima facie presumption has never been extended to a PBT. And I think Judge Anderson in the State versus Doar case got it exactly right when he expressly stated that the PBT does not receive a prima facie presumption regarding alcohol concentrations. If one steps back for a minute and examines the statutes in the administrative code and the record in this case, there really is a huge gulf between PBTs and what is now the ECIR-2. And it's not just the sophistication of the instrument that the department chose for evidentiary purposes, although that infrared technology, I think, that's built in is very important, and it has a superior ability in this record to, it's been testified to that it's got a superior ability to measure the deep alveolar lung air. It's also the protocol that gets followed when administering the test, the 20-minute observation period, the contemporaneous calibration checks, the bracketing air blanks, the requirement that there be two samples, that the substantial agreement between the two samples be less than 0.02. Certainly that needs to enter into the court's analysis because, strictly speaking, that would take the test outside of the purview of 343.303 because it was administered by a doctor, not law enforcement, and really not even at the direction of law enforcement. Now, where the court goes with that idea is...
You don't want us to go to... You don't want us to stray, but I think it's going to come up in conversation, so how would you like this to address?
Well, first of all, I'd like the court to keep in mind that if that's the reason why we might allow the test in this particular case. And as I've mentioned in the briefs, sort of the irony there is that we're really, now we have a PBT. Sure, it's not administered by law enforcement, but at the same time, then it's much less subject to control, quality control standards. We've got somebody that, we've got a nurse practitioner or whatever his title was, who's the one who's administering this test. And law enforcement officers are trained to administer these PBTs. And so there's a greater sense, plus they're using an instrument that the state has some control over and has certified and so forth. And so the test that the law enforcement officer would administer is going to be, I think, more reliable than what you might find in a hospital setting where, the rules are not quite as strict. For example, I know there's some point in the record where the Code of Federal Regulations requires PBTs in hospitals to be kept under lock and key and so forth. In this particular instance, it wasn't. It was just kind of sitting on a shelf somewhere.
Counsel, has it been your experience that in every homicide by intoxicated use case, there is chemical testing of some sort? In other words, stated differently, can the state meet its burden of proof regarding under the influence of an intoxicant without a chemical test result?
I certainly think that, that's possible. I don't think that chemical test evidence is required.
And how would the state, in your mind, legitimately go ahead and prove that without a chemical test result?
Well, there might be a testimony about how much the defendant drank. There could be a blood alcohol, sort of a Vic, or a blood alcohol concentration calculated off of that with expert testimony. Things that we don't have in this case, by the way. There could also be field sobriety tests, which show, the defendant is unable to perform those with any kind of dexterity. There could be, I think, any number of things that could theoretically substitute in for a chemical test.
I don't disagree with you. In fact, it might even be a little more mushy than that, it seems to me, because you just have to prove, I think, the state has to prove that they could not operate, physically manipulate or activate the controls necessary, and that, they weren't able to, that the operation was materially impaired by the consumption of alcohol. It doesn't have to be a specific number in order to prove the requisite intoxication to not be driving safely, right?
I would agree.
So, I mean, you don't have to be a 0.08 or... You could be less, you could be more, but the issue has to be whether you could manipulate the motor vehicle or whether that was impaired because of the consumption of alcohol to the requisite degree, right?
That's correct.
So,
but I guess I would hasten to add that in these kinds of cases, it's sort of universally agreed that the most powerful type of evidence that can be offered in a case like this is a chemical test evidence that's over the legal limit.
Right. And do you think the jury, here's my real question, do you think the jury instruction given is your strongest point here, or what do you think is your strongest point?
I think the jury instruction is the strongest point.
That's what you mean by prima facie case, isn't it?
That is what I mean, yeah.
Okay. And you're objecting that they're using this test and giving a number to mean that he's intoxicated. And that's the inference.
That's right, okay. Because I think that instruction, getting back to Justice Ziegler's point, is that the instruction basically allowed the jury to take this PBT test and not really have to consider some of those other things that would otherwise show intoxication. And to get to Justice Abramson's harmless error question, I mean, the state presents the issue here as sort of this was a level playing field and the jury got to hear the good and the bad about the PBT, and it was free to consider all the evidence and decide. But I think the jury instruction here really gave that PBT result a sort of a special status.
Was there rigorous cross-examination on the PBT?
Sure, there was a lot of cross-examination on the PBT. There was a lot of testimony on the PBT. There was both the CEO of the company that manufactures the instrument, the chief of the chemical test section, Susan Hackworthy, who was the one. She also testified, and the defense also presented an expert, former employee of the department, Mary McMurray.
And the state argues that all of that evidence is okay. Under the test then available. This is a pre-Daubert case.
Yes.
Pre-Daubert in our state.
Yes.
And that that's what you do when the jury decides reliability and the jury decides the weight. You don't disagree with that, do you?
I don't disagree with that as a principle that, yeah, that as a general rule, the jury decides the weight. But we've got this instruction, though, which kind of gives this PBT sort of what a stamp of approval, and I think fills in a significant gap in this case because there was no testimony in this record about the significance of what .08 was. But the instruction certainly supplied that gap. And there was actually no expert testimony to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty in this case that the .08 represented what Rocha Maya's alcohol concentration was at the time of the accident. And the instruction filled in that gap as well. And I note that this court decided in State versus Fonte, F-O-N-T-E, the court's decision suggested that such testimony is necessary to lay a foundation for a prima facie effect. I think this goes to the harmless error question, Justice Abramson, because I think this instruction really gave the PBT a big boost that it was not entitled to get. And I guess what I'm concerned about in this particular case is that basically what the state has done here is now we've kind of got the camel's nose under the tent in PBT cases. And there's a sign out there that says no camels allowed. But the state is saying, yeah, but you know what? This is not a camel. This is a dromedary. And there's some unintended consequences with that route.
Aren't there any cases that allow PBT? As evidence, aren't there any cases that allow PBT as evidence? When I read the state's brief, I thought there were cases that allow PBT to be brought in.
In certain kinds of cases, there are, but there are not in the OWI context.
Yeah, but in the OWI, it's the police who take these. In the OWI cases, the police took the PBT or gave the PBT. Here, it's not the police, so you're not quite under the statute that says no PBT in OWI cases. And when you use OWI cases, you're using the whole gamut of his convictions, not just the driving while intoxicated. not the mere homicide case here.
Right. I mean, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor, and that if you strictly read 343.303, you can't look at that and say, well, the legislature intended that a PBT in this particular context not come in at a trial. But as I pointed out, if you read it that strictly, you're opening the door for PBTs to come into these kinds of cases in other contexts that there could be some unintended consequences. There are now what they call intox box that are appearing in bars that uses the same technology as the IID, where people pay $1, $2 before they leave, and they can blow and have a breath test that tells them whether or not they're good to drive or not. That and the other analogies that I made about taking PBTs back at the jail, that's done routinely in these cases after a blood test. So I guess those get to come in now, too. And I think the legislature did not intend that. I see that. I think this is telling me that I've got 5 minutes left.
Got 5 minutes left in your main argument of 25 minutes, and then you have an additional five.
Oh, thank you.
So you're okay.
So I do think that we need to be, the court ought to give some thought to that, if we do start allowing PBTs in these kinds of cases simply because they weren't administered by law enforcement prior to the arrest, then that strict reading is going to open the door for PBTs and other varieties and other cases. In other words, there's a lot of potential dromedaries out there.
Could I ask, that's a very elementary question, how does the state get the results of the PBT? Do they get that by subpoena or warrant, or how do they get it?
You know, I don't know the answer to the question. I believe they got it by subpoena. I do remember when I first got this case, I thought it was interesting that that defense counsel maybe hadn't put up more of a fight on the confidentiality issue of medical records. I remember doing some quick research and thinking that might not have gone anywhere, so I didn't look any further at that issue. But I do think that they were subpoenaed. It was subpoenaed.
Is Quinn?
One other question. Was the PBT introduced at the preliminary examination? I mean, as I understand
no,
it, this
no, I don't know for sure, but I don't think so. Because one thing I do know is that it really wasn't even something that the district attorney was going to do until the original trial judge suggested it, which ultimately led to him recusing himself from this case.
It wasn't charged as a homicide by intoxicated use. That's the prelim stage.
It was.
Not.
It was not. That's correct. That's my understanding. So
it was added later.
It was added later after, again, the original trial judge had sort of suggested that to the prosecutor.
Well, I'm kind of wondering, obviously an information after a preliminary examination has to have some latitude. But, I mean, was there probable cause that the defendant was intoxicated in the preliminary examination?
I'm guessing that it probably was not, that didn't come up at the preliminary hearing.
But was there a challenge to it being transactionally related to the prelim? Was there a challenge made that this charge couldn't survive post-prelim?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Well, once the preliminary is done and there's a charge and a conviction, does the court go back to the preliminary and fix up problems?
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, once the reckless homicide charge survived the prelim, now the case was a felony had been proven. And
the recklessness was that he was drunk, or that he had been drinking, I assume.
Right. That was certainly
part of it. Or was it speeding?
And speeding.
Okay. Is there still an ineffective assistance of counsel claim here? Ending here?
No.
If I understand your argument, it is not so much that the PBT test absolutely cannot come in, but you're saying, hey, gang, if it comes in, there are going to be ramifications for the future. And in any event, the instruction just gave much emphasis and credibility to that test for this serious criminal charge. Is that sort of a fair summary or not?
It's mostly a fair summary, but I am also taking a strong position that it should not be allowed in at all in OWI cases, and that if you look at the legislature's, the way they've set this whole thing up with the two different kinds of breath tests, and the PBT is a preliminary screening tool. This court has noted that, and that it in and of itself is a prelude to a more sophisticated kind of test that the legislature has said can be used in these cases. So I am arguing, I think maybe the prima facie effect is stronger, but I am arguing that this should not be allowed at all in OWI cases, that's what the legislature intended.
Well, suppose you lose on this point. Are you going to be able to take the rule of law in some future OWI cases on behalf of the defendant?
Sure.
I mean, aren't you going to say, I'm going to use this stuff now?
Absolutely. We've had clients that have their own PBTs.
Except we have State versus Fisher decided by this court 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
We do. And I guess what I'll do is when I come back, I'll address the Fisher decision.
Well, while you're up, though, I have a comment. I'm looking at pages 41 and 42 of your opinion. Of your brief. And this is where you say, this is where you attack the jury instruction. And I just want to make sure I understand what your attack on the jury instruction is, since that is your prime argument here, although you have reserved your second and third and fourth arguments, too. If you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that there was 0.08 grams or more of alcohol in 210 liters of the defendant's breath at the time the test was taken, now my first question is, does the PBT, I know it was more than 0.08, but does the PBT do 210 liters?
I think the PBT does tend to try to extrapolate. I mean, obviously, it's a much smaller sample.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
Yeah.
All right. So maybe is that one thing the matter with this jury instruction? You may find that the defendant was under the operation of an intoxicant at the time of the alleged operating, but you're not required to do so. And your argument is that this jury instruction stems from 885-235-1GC, which is used in connection with quantitative breath tests under 343-305. And since we don't have a 343-305 test, that you shouldn't be using this instruction, and that there's a cross-reference in these statutes to each other.
That's correct.
That's your point.
Yeah, that's my main point.
And the state's going to argue that the PBT is a quantitative breath test. So.
Yeah, and I don't know that you can use a quantitative breath test in a qualitative way and a qualitative breath test in a quantitative way. I don't think that I'm relying so much anymore on those two different words, whether it's quantitative or qualitative. It was used quantitatively here, but it's clear that it was not the kind of test that was meant that the legislature intended to get this kind of a presumption, and this court has noted that as well on several prior occasions.
Thank you, counsel. And you should address Fisher on your rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state. Ms. Wellman.
It's down. Okay. Thank you. I guess it is now. May it please the court, I am Attorney General representing the state, which is the plaintiff respondent in this case. Let me address the instruction first, unless the court would like me to start with admissibility. And let's look at the language of the instruction itself, which the challenge part, which is that the jury was told that the law states that the alcohol concentration in the defendant's breath sample taken within 3 hours of operating a vehicle is evidence of the defendant's alcohol concentration at the time of the operating. And if you're satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt, there was 0.08 grams or more of alcohol in 210 liters of the defendant's breath at the time the test was taken. You may find that the defendant was under the influence of intoxication, of an intoxicant, at the time of the alleged operating, but you are not required to do so. You, the jury, are here to decide this question on the basis of all the evidence in this case, and you should not find the defendant was under the influence of intoxicant at the time of the alleged operating unless you are satisfied of that fact beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what the jury was told, and was told in this case.
So the jury's told if you find he had a 0.08 or above, you can infer he was intoxicated.
He was under the influence.
Nowhere else that the jury is instructed on a number and what to do with that number. And you don't think that's important?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I'm understanding the question.
The elements of this offense, unlike the elements of an OWI or BAC case, the elements don't involve a specific number that the jury has to find and what to do with that number. Here, the judge is telling the jury, if you find 0.08 or above, you can infer, because it's scientific, that this person was intoxicated. And the element the jury has to find isn't that they were 0.08 or above. The jury just has to find he was intoxicated. How is that not, how isn't the court telling the jury to find an element of the offense? Nowhere else are they told what that number means. Are they?
Well, what I was reading from that was given in this case is from the standard instruction on homicide by intoxicated user of a vehicle.
I understand that, but are you aware, are there any other cases in a homicide by intoxicated use case where PBT is admitted to prove intoxication?
I'm sorry, I didn't realize what your question was. I am not aware of any. I didn't find any. And normally that's because a PBT, as a term of art, refers to the preliminary breath test that's done by the police officer under 343-303 to establish probable cause. And this is not what happened here. This was a test taken by an emergency room nurse at the instruction of the emergency room doctor for diagnostic and treatment purposes that just happened to use the same machine, manufactured machine, that the police also used for the PBT. But all of the expert testimony here by both the CEO of the company and Susan Hackworthy of the chief state chemist of the DOT was that those machines operate identically as far as calculating the breath alcohol content, doing the math that gives you the numerical result, and they both give you the numerical result. So the machine itself doesn't work differently.
Do Do you think a PBT test result could be used to prove the state's case in chief in an OWI BAC case?
If by PBT you mean one taken by law enforcement,
yes.
It could not, because the statute 343.303 specifically says it's not admissible except for refusal or probable cause.
Why do you think that isn't admissible in an OWI?
Well, I think there are charge. A couple of reasons. The primary reason is what this court said, the majority of this court said in Fisher, which is the reason for that is to encourage people to agree to take the preliminary breath screening test, because unlike the later test under the implied consent law, there is no penalty for refusing to take the preliminary breath test. And so we want to encourage people to do that because it helps the police determine whether there is probable cause or not in a closed case where they have reason to suspect but aren't, you know, maybe not enough to be sure to go ahead and ask for an implied consent test, in which case if the person refuses, there are consequences of license suspension. And so that's what this court in Fisher said, and it specifically rejected the notion that even a law enforcement PBT is excluded from a homicide by drunk driving or OWI case because it's unreliable. This court said we found no indication in the legislative history that it's based on reliability, and if they were inherently or as a matter of law unreliable, one, we wouldn't use them to determine even probable cause, and two, they wouldn't be admissible for other offenses as they have been. And so it's not a reliability issue, and in fact, the state expert, the state chemist expert, Susan Hackworthy, testified that the reason they don't certify the Alco Sensor 4, which is the kind of machine used here, for use as evidence is not to do with reliability or accuracy. They are very accurate machines, and she gave a great deal of testimony about not only the, as did the CEO, about the accuracy of how the machine works, but Hackworthy, they both testified to the accuracy of the test in this case. Well, the CEO testified that given the calibration or the accuracy test both before and after the test in this case. Now, they weren't given by the emergency room nurse, but accuracy tests were taken 3 days before because it was over a weekend and the day after, and he looked at the log for long before that, and this particular machine that the emergency room nurse used had checked out to be accurate and precise over and over again. So
why do you think when someone's given the test after the PBT, why do you think law enforcement has to go through a questionnaire, explain it? Why do they have to sit there for a requisite period of time before they're tested? Why are they asked if they've regurgitated or anything like that? Why do those things happen if someone wants to measure breath reading by, you know, an intoximeter or some such device?
Right. My understanding is those are all requirements that are to enhance reliability and to limit the need for the state to put in expert testimony in each and every OWI case to show the reliability and accuracy of this kind of testing, these kind of machines. The protocols are partly a quid pro quo to both sides. The defendant is basically told, look, under this implied consent law, which I'm not criticizing, I think it's appropriate that we have it, but it is harsh in the sense that, well, just by driving on our roads and having a license, you're assumed to have consented, and if you don't give actual consent, we're going to yank your license for a while. That's a serious consequence, and so in order to make that more palatable and more likely that people will agree to it, the state has added all of these extra steps that law enforcement has to take. In return, then, when the approved evidentiary device is used and those steps are taken, the state doesn't have to bring in the experts to talk about the reliability and accuracy. So
the state gets the presumption.
Right. Well, not the presumption. That's a different thing. So to jump back to the instruction and the presumption, there's two different things.
Before you do that,
yes.
You were asked, I thought, whether in a homicide by intoxicated use of a motor vehicle, you had any cases that use the PBT. My question to you is, in that case, is it ordinary that blood alcohol test or a breath test would be used to show intoxicated use, or not necessary in light of the fact that the test really is whether or not you have sufficient control? You understand what I'm just saying?
It's both. It could be either or
I'm
both.
I'm sorry. I'm not sure I do understand the question.
Do you use a blood alcohol test or some test that's quantitative, that's acceptable without question, in that kind of case to show intoxicated use?
Oh, in an OW homicide, I assume yes, that they are frequently presented, although, of course, other evidence of intoxication or impaired driving is also presented.
So that this jury instruction would be given?
That's my understanding, yes, that it normally is given.
Okay. I haven't read all the cases involving this, so don't know, but we'll check.
I haven't done a great many OWI or homicide by drunk driving cases for over the years, but my understanding from people in office who have done a great deal of this is this is very unusual, even in a hospital setting, that they would do a breath test. Normally, they do a blood test. And I researched and had an assistant research, and neither of us could find, and maybe we just didn't find it, but neither of us found a case in another jurisdiction where it was a hospital test done for diagnostic and treatment purposes, but they did a breath test instead of a blood test.
I thought using a breath test to diagnose whether someone had a head injury was extraordinary, because you can be as drunk as a skunk and still have a head injury. So I don't see it as precluding it. I thought the record was quite interesting.
They did, in fact, go ahead in this case and do a CAT scan also, is my understanding. But, the doctor testified that, you know, it's just, it's cheaper and faster, so they use the breath test.
How long does it take to do the blood test? I know you can draw blood in seconds, but to test it.
My impression is it doesn't take that long, but there's nothing in this record about that.
All right.
I did want to get back to the instruction, because there's two different things going on here. One is the prima facie effect, which is what I read a few moments ago. And basically, all it's telling the jury is, because otherwise the jury has no way to relate the time of the taking of the test, which is always going to be later than the operation of the vehicle and the time of operating, because of course it's your breath alcohol or blood alcohol level at the time of operating that counts for any of the crimes. So the jury is told, well, if the test is within 3 hours, that's evidence of his level at the time of operation. And they're also, they need to know what is the relationship at all between this number and the element of operating under the influence. And so they're told that you may infer, you may find from this number, if it's 0.08 or above, that the person was under the influence of an intoxicant. But you don't have to. And also make that determination on all of the facts. So that's the instruction that was given here. And to me, that instruction doesn't really have anything to do with how you got that number. Because that instruction, except for the difference between the amount, you know, the different amount for blood and millimeters and the 2 10-liters for breath, but the number, the instruction is going to come in if you have a number over the legal limit, regardless of whether it's blood or alcohol. So what's important here is it tells the jury at the very beginning, if you find beyond a reasonable doubt that he was 0.08 or above, and that's where the accuracy of the test comes in and the reliability of the test, because the jury is going to find that number beyond a reasonable doubt only if they believe the state's evidence about the test result. And in this case, the jury was able to make that determination possibly to a greater degree than in most cases where you don't have expert testimony, because they had all of the testimony of the manufacturer, CEO, the state's chemist, chief chemist, both on the machine itself and how it works, and on the procedures in this case, and what was lacking and what wasn't, and, of course, the defense expert who thinks that this kind of instrument and test is totally cheesy and should never come in.
Ms. Wellman, I have a question tangentially related to the argument you're making now, and it's a combination. It's more of a factual question. Was there anything in the record to indicate that once PBT units are sent out to the various law enforcement agencies, that the law enforcement agencies can calibrate the PBTs, for example, to read a little lower than what the actual alcohol content of the driver might be in order to weed out borderline cases? As Justice Ziegler alluded to, there's the several hours of observation. The officers tend to be busy, and they don't typically, if they can avoid it, on a case that's going to be very dicey, they might calibrate the PBT a little lower so that the actual blood alcohol content reading is higher. Was there anything to indicate that different law enforcement agencies have the ability to do that?
No, there's nothing in this record about that at all. The other part of the instruction that was not given in this case, and I think this is important, is in the standard jury instruction, which is Wisconsin Jury Instruction Criminal 1185, which was given in part in this case. After the part about the 3 hours you can is evidence of the time at operation, and if he's 0.08 or above, you may infer, but you don't have to, that he was under the influence, then the printed standard jury instruction tells the judge, if an approved testing device is involved, the following may be added. And then comes in the presumption of accuracy instruction, which is the law recognizes that the testing device used in this case uses a scientifically sound method of measuring the alcohol concentration of an individual. The state is not required to prove the underlying scientific reliability of the method used by the testing device, but is required to establish the testing device was in proper working order and was correctly operated by a qualified person. Now, that was not given in this case because it was not an approved device, meaning one approved by DOT for evidentiary purposes. I think it's important for two reasons. The first reason is that by saying if an approved testing device is involved, the jury instruction committee obviously contemplated there may be cases where it's not an approved testing device, but the evidence still comes in. In that case, you would still get the prima facie effect, because if the jury finds beyond a reasonable doubt, and under the evidence could find beyond a reasonable doubt, that the result was 0.08, there's no reason not to allow them to make the inferences regarding relate back to operation and 0.08 or above constitutes under the influence. But you wouldn't give the instruction that this is a testing device that's scientifically sound. That's why we had to have expert testimony in this case, because this was not a law enforcement approved test. This was not law enforcement at all. And not only does it go to the instruction, but it seems to me that to say, well, the legislature couldn't have intended these inferences to be drawn or the evidence to be admissible when it's a test taken by hospital staff for medical and treatment and diagnosis that they're willing to rely on in important medical determinations to determine what to do next, what they might or might not be able to safely give this patient, all those kinds of things. To think that, well, when the legislature wrote the laws about implied consent and preliminary breath tests, all in the context of law enforcement, that they also intended to exclude and not give even the inferences that are allowed to be given in any other case to a very different test given for a different purpose, that the state has to come in and independently prove to the jury is reliable and credible enough and accurate enough to believe in this particular case. I don't think that that's a fair inference of legislative intent. I don't think there's any indication of that. And 885.235 does not refer back to 343.305. It doesn't talk at all about an instrument approved by the department for evidentiary purpose. None of that is in that statute. So to say, well, the legislature never intended it to apply to this kind of a test, I don't think you can say that based on the language of the statute itself.
May I ask this? If you prevail here, will a defendant be able to use a PBT-type test as a defense in every case where the PBT is not taken by a police officer?
No. Well, let me just define our terms first. First, by PBT, that's, to me, a term of art we use for the preliminary breath test that the law enforcement officer does. If what you're asking is if a test is taken using the alcohol sensor 4, which is the kind of the machine that was used here, that was taken, say, in this case, by the hospital, under the procedures that they used, if it had favored the defendant instead of the state, would the defendant be able to bring that in? And I think my answer would have to be yes, if he also brought in, he would have to lay the foundation and present the expert testimony to show that it's sufficiently reliable to be relevant, and then the jury can hear it, and then he'd have to present it to the jury for them to make a determination of credibility and accuracy in the particular case.
And the state may...
But it seems to me, once the door is opened here, we don't have to have one of these preliminary breath tests taken in the hospital. If it's reliable, if it can be used in this case, it seems to me it can be used in any case. So long as it's not taken by a police officer.
If you have the evidence, as we had in this case, that the person who took it is trained to use the machine correctly, which the emergency room nurse testified he had been trained and was experienced in using the machine, and the person who, under their hospital setup, did the accuracy checks came in and testified that she had been trained by the manufacturer to do the accuracy checks and to calibrate it when necessary. So you'd have to have all of that kind of testimony in any case. And so if you did have, I've not heard of these machines in bars before, but if a bartender used one of these machines and it favored the defendant, and then 5 minutes later the police stop him and he gets a higher test than the police test, if he wanted to bring that in and could show all of these things that we showed in this case, including the machine had been tested, it was shown to be accurate, the operator, the bartender knew what he was doing, had been trained, experienced in using it, the machine itself, and all of that, then under the Wisconsin's general evidentiary standards, I don't see why it wouldn't come in.
What about the Daubert standard, which applies after the effective date, after this case?
Right, and I haven't actually had a post-Daubert Wisconsin case yet to know exactly how that's been interpreted. My understanding is there have not been challenges to these breath testing devices themselves under Daubert, that they are accepted. And whether that extends further than that to the particular operator and all that, I'm sorry, I just don't know.
Ms. Wellman, assuming for a minute that this was error, what's your harmless error analysis? What's your argument in that regard?
Well, our harmless error argument on the instruction is it's a little hard for me to articulate the harmless error argument on the instruction itself because I'm not sure what part of the instruction would be found to be
just
error.
Just zeroing in on the admissibility to begin with.
To center in on the admissibility, it seems to me that in this particular case where you had evidence of that the defendant was driving under the influence, plenty of other evidence that was driving under the influence, particularly not only the doctor and the nurse's testimony that he smelled of alcohol, that he was confused, that he told them he had been drinking, and the accident happened right after he left the bar. His own statement to the police officer about how much he had been drinking at home before he went to the bar, at the bar, which I believe totaled at least 9 beers in that period of time, that in fact he bought beer from the bar to take with him when he left, and he opened one and he finished one of them as he was getting in the car and starting to drive. When the police found the car, they found both open and empty, open, empty, and closed beer containers in the car. His reckless driving in and of itself, even if you believe that the motorcycle people started the fracas, which was basically a big part of his defense, is that he was trying to get away from these frightening, intimidating people, one of whom had thrown something, a baton, and broken his window. And so his driving 75, 80 miles an hour, speeding, and how the accident occurred wasn't really reckless because he was in danger or thought he was in danger. You know, with all of that evidence, including just his choices when he's afraid of these motorcyclists, and the two of them are they're ahead of him, and yet he's speeding up to try to catch up with them. We think that based on all of that testimony taken together, and given the testimony by the defense that although the jury was entitled to believe that the test result was accurate, it certainly was attacked by the defense. We believe that it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that even absent the error, even if the evidence of the test result had not come in, the jury would have convicted beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counselor, didn't he say that he thought there was still the motorcyclist who had a woman riding with him who was behind him?
Yes,
so
he
thought
say.
He was being chased. He didn't know that they turned off.
Right. He did say that he thought one was still behind him.
Oh, that has something to do with how fast he was driving.
That would be part of the credibility of determination of which story was true.
Counsel, in response to Justice Crooks's question, you said it was clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the jury would have convicted, and indeed that is part of what is in your brief, page 31, citing Weed. And in the past, you've also cited Weed for the test of, in light of the entire record, it appears beyond a reasonable doubt that the alleged errors did not contribute to the verdict. This court can conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that a rational jury would have convicted the defendant absent the errors. Why do you choose that test? We've had several iterations of the harmless error test. Why do you choose this test, as you set out from Weed, as the one you hang your hat on?
Well, it's my understanding that it is the test in Wisconsin. And my understanding of Weed, and I can't quote it exactly, is that I think it's Weed that went on to say that if you can show it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that absent the error, the jury would have convicted, then you have shown that it's clear beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict. There are two ways of saying the same thing. And I think, I'm not positive, but I think in the one of the more recent harmless error cases, Roshan Smith, which is a couple of years old, this court used the clear beyond a reasonable doubt Harvey Nader Weed formulation. Absent the error, the jury would have convicted. Which is, so that's why I used that test.
The defendant and these motorcycle people know each other? Have they been drinking together?
No, there's no evidence. The defendant, as I recall the facts, the defendant was in his vehicle.
They weren't in the bar together.
Yeah, and they came out of the parking lot on their motorcycles. So
they weren't at the bar together?
No.
They were just accidentally at the same time, in the roughly the same area.
Yes, that's my understanding. Mm-hmm. And there was a great deal of dispute about what actually happened and who was doing what. I mean, that was a very hotly contested part of the case.
What was the defendant driving?
He was driving a car. I don't remember what kind.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your opposing counsel had a rather elaborate statement of facts, and you didn't really answer that. You just said, well, there's a lot of evidence on the other side. Okay, give me your best shot. Where were the facts misstated by the other side?
Well, I guess I wouldn't characterize it as misstatements, but as facts that characterize it from the defendant's viewpoint.
You characterize it as partisan, if I remember your brief. You characterize the defendant's statement of facts as partisan, favorable to the defendant, and that where there's a conviction, then on appeal you have to characterize it as favorable to the state, was your position.
Right.
Is that right?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I caught the last part.
Is that correct? That's your position? It should be stated favorably to the state?
For a sufficiency of the evidence argument, it certainly should. And he's not challenging the sufficiency. And the reason I call it partisan, for example, is one of his headings. I'm looking at page 10 of his brief in chief. He has a heading B, delayed and false reporting by the cyclists. And, you know, those are all credibility determinations for the jury to make as to why the cyclist didn't talk to the police right away, whether it was false, whether if the inconsistencies were falsehoods or if they were just the kind of inaccuracy that people make when they're describing, a traumatic event. He characterizes the one driver as a dark figure in this event. So that's what I'm talking about in terms of.
Isn't it true that the deceased's sister didn't really come forward? Isn't it true that the person with the deceased sister had just had his motorcycle smashed up and didn't come forward? I mean, aren't there some reasonable inferences to be drawn from that?
Well, as I recall, the deceased sister and I think her companion immediately went to the hospital where her brother was taken. He was still alive at the scene of the crime, although he was at the scene of the accident, although he was in very bad shape. And he was rushed to the hospital. My recollection is they followed him to the hospital. So their priority was to be with her brother, who had been seriously hurt, dying, and ultimately did die at the hospital. I don't recall that the record specifies how they came to then come to talk to the police later. She says they didn't talk to the police at the scene because the police didn't ask them anything and they went to the hospital. And then there's a gap of time when they do go to the police station and talk to the police. And I don't think the record talks about how that came about.
How long did the jury deliberate here?
I did just want to answer one question that was brought up before, which was that the prosecutor did get the test results via subpoena from the trial court judge. And 90504, which is the physician's patient privilege, has two exceptions that I believe would apply here, although this was never challenged below. And one would be that there's no physician-patient privilege when it relates to a homicide and the cause of the homicide. And then there's a specific one for there's no privilege regarding chemical tests for alcohol content. So I don't think that's an issue.
I thought they deliberated 4 days. Am I right?
Yes. Yes. And it's interesting. If you look at document 72, which is the envelope that has, there were several jury questions sent out. Only one of those jury questions had anything to do with the operating under the influence, and that was they asked for a further definition of the term materially impaired. All of the others really were focused on the recklessness, and I don't remember all of them, but one of them was for a clarification of whether the utter disregard to human life element of reckless homicide, whether that relates to the human life of the person he was involved with or human life in general, like reckless, utter disregard of anybody around. So all of the other questions also went to other things other than this. Not that means that the jury didn't, consider the homicide carefully, but in terms of whether what they were really struggling with. We can't say that they were struggling with this, you know, test result and scientific evidence, as opposed to the vast majority of the case in terms of how it was tried was really focused on who was at fault here, who started this, did the motorcyclist start this, was the defendant really at fault at all, or even if he was what would be reckless under other circumstances, was he really not being reckless here because he felt threatened? And so it all really had to do mostly with that, as far as the factual underlying how it happened, factual presentation.
If there are no further questions, thank you, Ms.
Thank
Norman.
You.
Mr. Anderig.
The gap in time between the accident and the state's witnesses coming forward to talk to police was certainly long enough for all of them to sober up, I would say. The vehicle that Mr. Rochamayo was driving was a Ford Taurus. Justice Abramson asked that question. Motorcycles did come out of a parking lot. It was the parking lot of a bar. When the witnesses did come forward, they didn't tell the whole story. They didn't say anything about throwing a metal baton through the guy's window. The deceased sister and her boyfriend did go to the scene. I think they did, from the scene, go to the hospital, but they never talked to police. Police didn't ask them any questions, so they didn't volunteer anything of what they had just seen. But I promised to talk about this court's decision in Fisher, which has certainly been something of a thorn in my side. And I say that, of course, with all due respect to the majority opinion in this case. But the way I view Fisher is not so much as an overt endorsement of the reliability of a PBT, but more of a finding that there was no express legislative concern in that regard when it created 343.303. The legislature, this court in Fisher said, wanted to induce OWI suspects to submit to PBTs. I don't think that's tantamount to a legislative proclamation that the PBT is a reliable instrument. And it's just as likely, it may be probable, that the legislature never really addressed the reliability issue of the PBT because it already had in place a strong protocol for breath tests that it had declared are admissible. And after all, it was declaring the PBT inadmissible in the section that it was enacting. So the same, I think, is somewhat true, and at least could be said, of this court's decision in Fisher, that once it decided, this court, that is, that the legislature was motivated by inducing compliance, and given that the legislative history said nothing really good or bad about the reliability of the PBT, a closer look at how the legislature would have regarded the PBT in an OWI trials was certainly not necessary for this court's decision. After all, the PBT was deemed inadmissible by all seven justices of this court. But this case, strips away that aspect of legislative intent and requires this court to confront how the legislature really regarded the PBT as an evidentiary instrument in the OWI context. And I think this case, especially when viewed in the way of Fisher, represents something of a fork in the road. With regard to the jury instruction and counsel's remarks about how, it wasn't quite as bad as it would have been in a normal OWI case, that there were some modifications made. On the actual language of the prima facie effect, the only difference between what is normally read in the standard jury instruction and what was read in this case is the removal of the word alone. Instead of you may find from the .08 PBT alone that the defendant was intoxicated, it was you may find from the .08 PBT that the defendant was intoxicated. And by the way, the bit about telling the jury that it can consider all of the other evidence, which is part, that's also part of the standard instruction. It wasn't something special here. And while the idea of removing the word alone might seem at first blush to be meaningful, it's really not, if you think about it, because the exact same idea is conveyed. The jury was still instructed it could find Mr. Rochamaya intoxicated based on the 0.08 PBT. It was not told that it was required to do so. Yes, it was told it could consider all of the evidence. But at the end of the day, it was told if you decide that he is 0.08 or above, you can find that he was intoxicated. And there was no testimony in the record that indicated what 0.08 means. In terms of intoxication, and again, nothing that even no expert testimony to tie the test result up to the time of operation. And in this context, telling the jury that it was not required to do so is tantamount to telling it that, but you could do so. And we don't know, of course, what went down during the jury deliberations. Counsel has referenced some notes that were sent out. But we do know they were arduous, they were protracted. And I think one plausible explanation is the jury could have struggled with this issue and decided ultimately that the 0.08 resolved it. Something that I didn't get to finish, so I'm going to just take 15 seconds here, is all of the additional safeguards that go with the 343.305 test that is entitled to this presumption. I started going through them. But I didn't, you know, there's also the statutory safeguard of the alternate test, which this court has said it will strictly protect, not as a due process right, but as a statutory right in Wallstead and McCrossin. There's rigorous maintenance requirements for the testing of the instrument, trained technicians, that it must certify its accuracy not only before the regular use, but every 120 days afterwards. There's specific standards for training the operators, training manuals and courses, DOT certifying qualifications and competence, permits being issued, requirement for individualized certification of each law enforcement agency in terms of site location and security. A lot of thought went into this. And if the whole scheme is carefully constructed by the legislature and the department for evidentiary tests, were thought of as a CAT scan, for example, the PBT would be an X-ray. It'll give you some information, but I don't think you want anybody opening up your body and operating based on that. And it's certainly not the type of test that is entitled or should be sharing the prima facie effect that its big brother gets. So thank you to the members of the court for considering my opinions today.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank you both for yet another argument relating to PBTs in a different fact situation. And so ends our discussion of 11AP 2548 CR State versus Louis M. Rocha Mayo. The court will take a recess in a few minutes, allow counsel to leave and counsel for the following case to come to the podium. We're in recess.